Sydney on the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips, and Glenn is my wonderful friend from New Zealand. He's a marine biologist and outdoor water scuba diving enthusiast and writer and many different things. But Glenn, I really want to thank you for taking the time. I think this is the it's been 2 or 3 years since we've done an interview, but we did 3 or 4 there back a while back.
Yeah, tenakoi, Jeff. I think it might be our 4th one, and good to hear your voice again. And greetings, everybody, from Aotearoa, New Zealand.
What's happened in New Zealand since the middle of March?
Well, I guess we've been experiencing crazy times like everybody else has, and it's clear that there are different experiences around the world. You know, here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, we've been shielded by our isolation partly from the ravages of this current particular virus. And you know, Jeff, I won't go into my personal views on the human response to being a part of a world that also includes viruses. But, you know, just from the experience of being here, a government that's responsive, a government that actually, in this particular instant anyway, has shown an awful lot of compassion and care for the people of this land. And so, you know, to be honest, it's been like a bit of a holiday. It's been this holiday from hustle, bustle, speed, drive to be doing things. And so for lots and lots of folks here, it's been a chance to step back, breathe, and just reflect on life. And you know where we live, Jeff. We live up on a beautiful hill overlooking the Pacific Ocean. And so it's a nice, quiet place here anyway, but over the last 6 weeks, the only sounds that we've been listening to are the sounds of our bird song, the sounds of the wind talking to the trees, and it's just been incredible.
Well, isn't that, that's so fantastic.
Notwithstanding that things are bad for people, and you know, my heart goes out to anybody who's been suffering, either from the virus itself or from the human response to the virus.
Yes, well, what I said in the very first week or two of all this, before it was even clear kind of what was going on, I go like, but look, everything's being disrupted, and so this is a great opportunity. You've got time. No matter what, if you're still okay, you've got food to eat and a place to live, you've got the beautiful gift of time, which could be, you can't, it's priceless. And I go like, there's so many people that say, oh, you know, I just, you know, if I ever get around to it, I'll be able to do that. And so it was ironic that, remember I told you I was house sitting, staying at that farmhouse at Matapuri there, close to you, back in late February, early March. And on their wall, he had this round red thing called a round tuit. And it was a red disc, and it had a little thing that goes like, you know, so now you've got a round to it. You can never again use that as an excuse for not doing something. And so I go like, but look, you know, this is a chance for people to learn how to play the flute, to learn how to paint, to write the book they've always wanted to do, to spend time with their family. You know, it was a gift of time, and it's still been that all along. And so, but you know, but dude, if you don't mind, take just a couple of minutes and tell me about what you were going to say about the human response to all this stuff.
Viruses have been around since the beginning of life, you know, at least 3.9 billion years, as far as we know. And you know, there are some scientists who like to argue that viruses aren't really living things. You know, I'm not going to argue with them, but I'll just say that for me, everything is alive. You know, I'm an animist. The rocks are alive. The water is a living being. So to single out viruses and say they're not living things just doesn't fly for me personally. So given that, if we want to treat another living thing or a community of living things as enemies, Well, it kind of fits in with the way that humanity's gone, where we like to have enemies and we like to have wars, and if we have an enemy, we've got something to fight against.
And to capitalize on.
A virus that is just doing its thing, this work of balancing the ebb and flow of life to turn that into an enemy instead of seeing it as a messenger, as a pointer to imbalance. You know, for me, that it's not a very helpful or very positive way to go. You know, while I have the utmost sympathy for people who are really badly affected on a personal level, if we want to make progress and move forward, we've got to get away from this idea of separation and that we're separate from everything.
Yes.
From a point of non-separation, the virus is here to help us understand the imbalances that we're creating.
Yes, that's very interesting. As I understand it, the standard model is that viruses are kind of on the border between, they're not actually fully biological organisms, but they're basically genetic information, DNA and RNA, and they sort of go into a cell and they take over the cell, or they take over the control systems and then get the organism to do what the virus wants it to do. But it's very complex. Bill Bryson, in his great book, A Short History of Nearly Everything, he's got a great chapter called Small World, where he talks about all this stuff. A lot of times, virus is like you're saying, they're part of what's been here all along. And another whole interesting thing is that viruses might have even come from not on the Earth, you know, and life itself, this panspermia theory and stuff, it's sort of like a cosmological animism. And I really identify. I think I too am an animist. Viruses, it's the ones that make us sick that we know about. There could be heaps of them that are doing beneficial things that we just don't understand, you know. And it's like, so it's a very interesting thing for speculation. And then we haven't even talked about, are viruses able to go like down in the ocean, you know, and stuff like that. But that's sort of secondary to what we're talking about. But were you cut off from being able to go on your boat for long?
Yeah, in fact, haven't actually been out to my beautiful islands, Tafitirahi, now for a couple of months.
Are you able to do that now?
In our Rahui, our restriction, our lockdown, we weren't allowed to go out on the ocean at all. Nobody was allowed to even go swimming.
Can you now?
You know, for inverted commas, health and safety reasons. So yeah, I'm sitting here now, looking out to Moana Nui Akiwa, the Pacific Ocean, and looking forward to this coming weekend, because I'm going to be getting out diving out of the islands again this weekend. So really looking forward to it. Hey, just want to just touch on something you just said about viruses in the ocean, and viruses in the ocean are a really good example of that beneficial aspect and service that viruses do, because, you know, viruses play a really important role in the balance of phytoplankton blooms. And this working together, the viruses working within the plankton blooms, are one of the major and most beautiful controlling factors of nutrient cycling in the ocean. So, yeah. Like most things, you know, if we only focus on the negatives, we miss a big part of the story.
Yes, that is another very interesting side effect of the whole, I'll only say this word once, coronavirus. Oh my God, how many times have we heard that in the past couple of months? Ad nauseum, but at least, how many times have you heard anybody talk about climate change during this time? It's been completely dethroned as the, you know, one of the main things that we have to worry about. But look, let me just throw this out. We've talked before about the uniqueness of water and the powers and special characteristics that water has, and especially salt water in the ocean. Well, guess what? I've experienced several times this past week, for really the first time, really since many, many years ago on the South Island or when I was in Chile, ice. We've had three or four mornings with several degrees below zero, and I have a little bird bath and it was frozen solid, about 10 centimeters thick. And it was just, I did so much photography, I was just captivated by the ice because I hadn't really, it's like I was seeing it for the first time. And just so, that's probably something you don't see very much of over there in Aotearoa. But it's quite a...
Ice is not part of my daily life, and I can really get what you're saying. You know, the miraculous qualities of living water, the living nature of water has become a really big focus for me over the last couple of years.
Yes.
Maybe we can talk about that a bit later.
Absolutely. Well, and it's also very interesting. When I go swimming in the ocean often, and I'll go again on Sunday up on the north coast of Tasmania, and I'm guessing the water temperature is about 13, maybe between 12 and 13. It's not freezing, but it's not warm either. And when you think of all the whales and dolphins and all the fish, but all the warm-blooded mammal beings that live in the ocean, they're able to handle water temperatures that would make Wim Hof shiver. You know what I'm saying? And they live there. They don't have to get out of it, you know? And it's like that is such an amazing, I don't even want to use the word adaptation, because it's not like they didn't, it's just how they are. But look, let's talk about our beautiful friend Wade Doak. I liken him to have been the Jacques Cousteau of New Zealand, although I learned that Jacques Cousteau had a major French Navy military background, which I don't know if Wade Doak ever had a military background, but just to set the stage, Wade and I corresponded in these little sort of, it was a one sheet of paper that you'd fold in three parts and then mail it. It was a New Zealand little sort of a folding letter thing. And we corresponded that way for many years based on our mutual love of the dolphins and his appreciation of John Lilly's group that I was involved with. And he had a thing called Project Interlock that involved a woman from Florida. And so we corresponded. And then when I first arrived to New Zealand in February of 2000, I went and stayed with him and Jan for a couple of nights. And I've actually got an interview I filmed with him that's on a different format of video footage that I've got to get out next time I'm back in New Zealand. But so you knew Wade for, was he someone that inspired you to become an oceanographer?
Absolutely, yeah. And just if I may, Jeff, I just also want to acknowledge that last year we not only lost two giant kauri of the ocean world, so Wade and also Dr. Roger Grace, who was a contemporary of Wade's, just a few years younger. And Roger was really the first marine biologist in New Zealand to use scuba to start exploring the ocean in a scientific way.
Really?
He was a real pioneer as well.
I've never heard of him before.
Also great friends.
Never heard.
Other.
Did you know Roger?
A lot of diving together.
Did you know Grace?
I first read one of Wade's books probably in the early 1980s, and it was a book called Beneath New Zealand Seas, and it's still here right on my bookshelf right beside me now, next to another one of Wade's books called The Cliff Dwellers, which is probably the second book of his that I read, and that's right next to another one called Sharks and Other Ancestors. And these were some of Wade's earlier books, and I was reading them when I first started working as a professional diver back in 1986, and I happened to be working in an aquarium called Kelly Tarleton's Underwater World as a diver, and Kelly Tarleton was one of the early New Zealand pioneer divers, and him and Wade were great friends, and they went on enormous adventures together, including lots and lots of wreck diving and treasure hunting. And so Wade started much of his early diving, like so many people back in the 1960s. It was all about treasure hunting. And no, Wade didn't have a military background, but through those years when they were hunting for treasure, they got to use a fair amount of explosives underwater.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So we were, I don't know if that would have had anything to do with his sort of the degenerative health issues he had in his later years. I knew another guy that used to dive for abalones in Western Australia, and he would dive down with they'd have a compressor on the boat, and he'd have an airline, and this guy could somehow. This is his story, as he told me, but he had the ability to stay down like three times longer than anybody else, and so he would typically do that, but they all hated him because he could get way more abalones and stuff. And so, but he reckoned, when I met him, it's been probably 15 years ago since I've seen him, but he wasn't any older than me, you know, like maybe early 60s, and I mean, you know, 50s then, but he was having all kind of degenerative problems with his joints, and all his gums had deteriorated, so all his teeth had fallen out, and he attributed it to all the, would it have been the mixture he was breathing, or being down at that, you know, with the pressure differential and stuff like that. But anyway, he attributed it to that, and I was wondering if Wade had a similar thing from just his probably thousands of hours spent under the water.
You know, it's really hard to say, actually, Jeff. The diving medicine has been around for quite a while now, but
yes,
it's incredible how little we still know about the physiological effects of being under pressure has long term. But clearly, when, like, for instance, commercial divers are doing saturation diving, where they're actually super saturated in nitrogen and have to spend a week in a recompression chamber slowly decompressing.
Oh my God.
You know, now they definitely have real issues with bone necrosis and that sort of thing. Basically, their bones just turning to dust. So, you know, it's quite possible Wade had some, you know, his joints were getting pretty creaky, and especially his hips and things. But, you know, the other thing, dear Wade would spend hours and hours and hours sitting in pretty uncomfortable chairs in front of computers and before computers in front of his writing desk, writing, and, you know, which was one of his great gifts.
Yes.
And so, it's hard to say whether, you know, or maybe it's a combination of all that time underwater and all that time sitting in front of his writing desk.
You'll have to be sure to not do too much of either of those yourself.
Yeah, well, these days I do a lot of free diving, so it's breath hold diving.
For real?
So you're not uptaking the nitrogen loading as much as you do on scuba diving.
Yes. Well, so why did...
Yeah, hopefully I'll be okay. But, you know, if you've got to go, you've got to go some way. And I wouldn't give up my time in Mother Ocean just for a few creaky joints. And I'm pretty sure Wade wouldn't have either.
Exactly. And so let me just ask you a technical question, because I've become very interested in nitrogen in the past few months. And I'll tell you more about that later if we have a chance. But why so the air that you breathe in a tank, what is it? I mean, surely it's got what percent oxygen, and then what else is in there?
So, you know, when you're just doing standard scuba diving, it's just air. So, you know, air, when we say just air, what an insult. Air is the breath of life. And that breath of life currently is around 21% oxygen and around about 78.5% nitrogen, and then about 0.5% of other trace gases, including, of course, the beautiful and important carbon dioxide.
So we can photosynthesize.
And other trace gases as well. And, you know, so when I was first studying physiology and chemistry as it applies to diving, one of the things that we were taught was that nitrogen is an inert gas. And in terms of respiration in a oxygen respiring organism like ourselves, nitrogen doesn't play a role in respiration. But nitrogen plays a hugely important role in every other facet of biological function for all organisms. And so it's just a big insult to talk about nitrogen as being this inert gas, this gas that doesn't really matter. It's just a space filler from the you know, the modern medical paradigm thinking.
Well, how about space? It's like they say that we only use 10% of our brain, and the other 90% is just redundant. It's kind of like that.
Yeah, right.
It's got where the junk DNA. This is all the stuff. If we took it all away, everything would just collapse. But we can't acknowledge it. But so what? Tell me what is nitrogen narcosis?
So what happens with the nitrogen? Of course, when you go diving, as soon as you leave the surface and you start descending, you're being subjected to increased pressure. And when you get to 10 meters of seawater, you're in two atmospheres of pressure. So you've doubled the pressure that's on you. And so you've got the surface pressure from the atmosphere, plus you've got another atmosphere's worth of pressure in that first 10 meters. And for every 10 meters, you get another atmosphere of pressure. So in metrics, we call that bar. So, you know, you're at one bar of pressure at the surface, two bars of pressure at 10 meters, three bars at 20 meters, and so on. Now, that affects gases. And so with gases, we talk about partial pressures. So at the surface, the partial pressure of nitrogen in the gas, which is air, is 78%, just over. But when you, so that's 0.78 partial pressure. When you get to 10 meters, that partial pressure becomes 1.56. And then as you go further and further down, that partial pressure starts increasing. Now, what that basically means is, gases really love equilibrium. And so in our bodies, that partial pressure of gas becomes really important. In our bodies with nitrogen, because we're not metabolizing it with our respiration, and nitrogen can basically build up in our bodies. And if it builds up too much, we have a problem with potential decompression illness, which is the nitrogen gases going into solution in our blood and forming gas bubbles in our blood. Nitrogen narcosis is when the nitrogen interferes with the nerve pathways in our body, and so it interferes with information, with communication throughout our body. And so nitrogen narcosis basically is just this nervous interference, pretty much the same as alcohol does and other drugs does. You know, it changes the way that our nervous system basically communicates with itself and with the rest of the body. And so nitrogen narcosis can be a narcotic effect, and so everybody has a different experience of that narcotic effect. For some people, it's like, you know, just being a bit stoned and everything's great. And in that situation, I've had experiences where I've been diving with people and they've actually taken their regulator out of the mouth at depth, trying to share it with the fish because they're just pretty stoned.
Mr. Limpet.
Yeah.
Have you experienced this yourself?
Yeah, just like people do with, you know, smoking a bit of grass. Some people get really paranoid, and so they have a really uncomfortable feeling with nitrogen narcosis, and it gets worse the deeper you go. But the difference between nitrogen narcosis and using drugs is that the effect wears off as soon as you start coming shallower. So by the time you back up into shallow waters, the effects of the nitrogen narcosis is gone completely.
Yes, and so what's the worst that you've experienced that yourself?
So doing some really deep dives, this sort of brings me back to Wade a little bit, because some of my early deep dives were actually with Wade and with Roger and other people, pioneer divers, the grandfathers of New Zealand diving, and they used to dive deep, really deep. And I'm talking about deep for scuba diving. Deep is anything really over 100 feet or 30 odd meters, but that's the modern version of deep. For these guys, when they were diving deep, they were diving down to 200 feet or 220 feet, so you know, 60 to 70 meters below the surface. Now the effects of nitrogen narcosis at those depths is really extreme. So that my experiences of diving around those depths between 60 and 70 meters, which I used to do in my younger days, you basically get the feeling that your whole face goes completely numb. And I was in the habit of just having my hand over my regulator just to make sure that it was still in my mouth, because I couldn't feel it.
Yes,
in my mouth.
Very interesting. Did you ever see any sea monsters under those conditions?
No. I mean, I was one of these people where, back in those days anyway, everything was pretty euphoric for me with nitrogen narcosis. So
yes.
I was always in a happy place. And
well,
you kind of get addicted to it.
Well, I was going to say.
So deep diving, you get addicted to that feeling.
Yeah,
so.
I'm sure. Terry Lilly's kind of talked about that. And then there's this stuff called nitrous oxide laughing gas. It's like an anesthetic that makes people really, I've done that before. And it's like, you know, so it's very, very interesting. Well, look, so tell us a bit more about Wade Doak. What would you say his greatest contributions were? What was his greatest loves? When I stayed with them, he loved to watch. He put on his TV screen underwater footage that he shot of schools of fish and stuff, and was listening to my music, like this new grand piano recording that I had just done when I arrived here. And so he really liked my music. He thought it went along with his footage, but he did a lot of underwater photography and Project Interlock. And so he got into the ocean from the treasure hunting's perspective, but then fell in love with the whales and dolphins and the fish and everybody?
Absolutely, yeah. So when Wade wrote more as a kind of an autobiography called Gaia Calls, he did that in, I think, 2013 or 2014. And at the beginning of that book, he said something really interesting. He said, so finally the truth can come out. And then he went on to relay a story of deja vu, like, I've been here before. And this was up at the Three Kings Islands, way up north of the tip of the North Island. And they were diving on the wreck of the Alingamite, which is a ship that had sunk up there in a storm, and it was filled with the Rothschild jewels and with lots and lots of gold and silver coins. And they were blasting this wreck to smithereens to try and recover all of the gold and jewelry and everything, which they did. But he was down there. He had this incredible sense of being there before. And you know what? This happened just before he found the very first gold coin of the expedition. So they knew they were on the right wreck because he found this coin, and he knew he was going to find it because he'd been there before. This is how Wade started his autobiography. And he went on to talk about how being underwater changed his perspective, and that perspective became, you know, what is life? What is life? And his love of the underwater world shifted into trying to get some kind of understanding about what life is about from an ocean perspective. And then he basically devoted the rest of his underwater time to really trying to understand life from an ocean perspective.
Yes, and you mean so like life in the sense of...
He fell in love with the fish, basically.
Yes, understanding like the nature of life itself, like as a, you know, the myriad expressions of DNA and that kind of thing.
Not long before Wade passed over, he had just completed a real seminal work on cetaceans, which was really focused on the relationship between humans and cetaceans and how people are drawn into those relationships.
Well, you're anticipating what I was going to ask you. So is that work, is it finished, or is it going to be published, or do you have a copy of it?
Yeah, so it was a trilogy, and at least two of the trilogy completed, and you can get them on Amazon as ebooks. He'd given up on trying to do print books a while back. For those of us that are involved in exploring the more than human world and wanting to write about it, you know, the age of self-publishing has been a godsend, really, and Wade really embraced that. As Wade embraced technology the whole way through his life.
Yes.
And so he just went into self-publishing and mostly electronic. So a lot of his stuff is available on Amazon as ebooks.
Okay. Well, now let me ask you this. Throughout your contact with him, did he ever talk with you about telepathic communication with whales and dolphins?
Yes, he did, but only in later years, Jeff. So this was something that Wade was quite careful about in sharing, because, you know, he'd built up quite a large following with his naturalist work. So and his work along with Jan in studying fish behaviour. Yeah, it's just still, to this day, they probably almost lead the world in as underwater naturalists. And so Wade and Jan both experienced direct mind-to-mind communication with cetaceans, but he didn't like to talk about it too much. But until later years, when he wrote Gaia Calls, he actually shared those experiences and wrote about them. And when I was writing my book, The Ocean is Alive, I wanted to share what they had experienced as part of my exploration of why it is that we have such a taboo around the idea of direct mind-to-mind communication. And so, yes, we had long conversations about their experiences. We had lots of conversations about what might actually be happening, and you know, when we're delving into those realms, of course we have to move beyond trying to understand things through physics and through physical laws, and we've got to move into explorations of energetic fields. And you know, Wade and Jan were never afraid to explore and to be open-minded. It's one of the things that drew me to them in the first place, and one of the things that continued and continues to inspire me is their open-mindedness.
Yes. Well, remember I told you about Project Interlock and that woman in Florida? Well, they talked about the telepathic communication quite a lot. So I think it was probably something that he knew it was real, but he was a bit reluctant to embrace it fully because of it seemed like kind of a fringe, kind of a hippie kind of concept or something like that. But I think it's probably, you know, it's actually quite scary when you realize that it's that kind of thing is an innate ability that we and probably all life forms have in varying degrees, but for us it can be really scary because, you know, it's kind of like the firewall may not be as absolute as we think sometimes. But you know, but on the other hand, you know, it's, I mean, we could maybe do another show sometime and talk about just the communication aspect. But you know, what if you had to know what everyone was thinking all the time?
Yeah,
exactly. So it's good that we're blocked off.
I need to have an off switch.
Exactly. You know, so it is. It's quite a when you think of how it can be. Like I've had spontaneous communication experiences in that kind of way, very powerful with dolphins on Great Barrier Island and stuff like that. But anyway, let me ask you this. I'm trying to keep moving and cover some different ground here. Did you ever hear of a guy named Frank Robeson, or did we ever talk about him?
No, I don't think we have, but yes, I have, and I actually I wrote about Frank's experiences with dolphins and his work of communication with dolphins as well, because he was really groundbreaking. Also,
did he and Wade know each other?
Another Kiwi who he got communicated with, and it wasn't, and it was always a case for him. He, from early childhood, he could communicate with all sorts of animals. I don't know if he ever went into communicating with non-animal forms of life, but he then became a world-leading expert in particularly in communicating with cetaceans, and travelled all around the world, working not only in a modern frame scientifically around the stuff, but now I think from what I can gather from reading Frank's work, he particularly was most interested in indigenous understandings of these forms of communication. And for me, it's the most normal thing. So I don't see these things as supernatural. I see them as supernatural.
Yes, I'd love to learn more about his work with indigenous understandings of whale and dolphin communication. And that's another whole thing. Did he and Wade know each other?
They did, but I don't know, and I don't want to speculate, but I don't believe that they collaborated at all.
Okay.
But I do know that, well, Wade wrote a book on interactions around the world with single dolphins, and, you know, most often these are bottlenose dolphins, and most often they're juvenile males. And I know that Wade covered in that book Frank's experiences with Horace, the juvenile teenage bottlenose dolphin down in the Hawke's Bay.
Yes, I remember that. Well, now let me ask you this: something that I have a pretty good amount of disdain for is people that are they're claiming that dolphins use language. They're going like, we're going to decode the dolphin language, or we're going to translate it into English. And I go like, but look, it doesn't work that way. And then I end up saying like, well, look, can you translate a symphony into English? Or Steve Martin, the comedian, who's also a really talented banjo player, he goes like, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. So what I wanted to ask you is, to throw this out, to me, there's a big difference between trying to study or analyze communication, for example, how whales and dolphins communicate. It's a whole different thing whether you're trying to analyze that or whether you want to understand what it is that they're trying to communicate. And the latter is what my path has really been, you know, about if they're communicating, what are they sharing?
I absolutely 100% agree with you, Jeff, and it's my interest as well. You know, decoding is a very linear.
Absolutely, approach.
And I believe that communication is all about meaning, and meaning is not linear.
No.
So, and my experiences with communicating or being communicated with humpback whales in particular has been all about meaning.
Well, would you say that
what happens is it's imagery,
yes,
rather than words? And I know that for some other people, the way it manifests in terms of meaning is through words and through that's how that meaning comes to people. So it is different, but ultimately it's about meaning.
Well, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, and so would you say that during all your many years of diving with the humpback whales, because you, as I remember, you took people, you had sort of like a tourism enterprise where people could go and swim with the whales, and you did that so that you could be near them yourself. And so would you say that any, we're a self, so how can you not be selfish? But anyway, but what I'm saying is, would you say, looking back over all your time with them, did any patterns emerge in the sense of the reason that they would seem to have communicated or shared something with you, or what the themes or motifs in what they shared, or any sort of regularities of that connection?
Yeah, I think that there's an underlying aspect which for me really comes through strongly as connectedness. So I'll say it like this, I guess, being present. That was one of the most powerful experiences that I've, as a theme. So every time where I'm in the water, even as sometimes even still on the boat, the sense of presence. So rather than there being sort of like a detail to a communication, there's just a presence. And that presence is, you know, we just call it being. And it's an act of acknowledging the non-separation. And so, and I'm using, trying to explain the meaning of this using language.
Yes.
The act of non-separation is how I can describe it. But the whales weren't trying to communicate that. They were just being that.
Exactly. Well, see, but that is so cool. And in a show, a radio show I did a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about how I was looking at some of the stuff that Terry Lilly had shared about he felt that there was a stronger sense of community or even friendship between all the different various critters that lived when he's down there diving with them and stuff. It's like everything's a little more connected, and it's exactly like what you're saying. And I went like, well, look, could that have anything to do with the fact that water is central to life as we know her? Most every living thing is mostly made of water. So when you're actually down in the water, and not just any water, but the ocean water that's very similar to our blood, for example, when you're immersed in the ocean, which is where we believe life might have originated to begin with, when you're down in there, the connection between everybody is even greater, or it's the true original level of connection that we always had. And it's sort of like water actually is kinship.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're just touching on stuff that's very, very close to my close to the surface for me at the moment. It's one of my main focuses at the moment is really delving into the meaning of being water beings.
Well, tell us a little more about that.
Everything is water.
Yes.
Life is just animated water, as Vladimir Vernadsky, the great Russian scientist, said. And our disconnection with our water being, for me, is the most severe symptom of our separation sickness. Now, I've just finished, just in the middle of the night, I've just been participating in an ocean summit as a panelist, and myself and a Maori academic from Auckland University, Dr. Dan Hikoroa, our kaupapa, our purpose for being on this panel was to talk about the ocean as a living being. And, what I was focusing on was that water is the living essence of everything. And, you know, interesting thing, no matter which way you look at it, water is the facilitator of life. I'll go further and I'll postulate that life is brought into existence to facilitate or further facilitate the flow of water. The flow of water facilitates the conservation of energy. So this does not in any way conflict with our understanding of thermodynamics or the law of energy conservation. In fact, if we look at it from that perspective, just this physical perspective, the evolution of life makes perfect sense to enhance the conservation of energy through the flow of water, in other words, through the water cycle. Now, that's only the purely physical, and of course, there's the metaphysical, the spiritual aspect, and none of those things are separate. They're all part of the flow of water. So, water is life. I finished off the panel discussion in the middle of the night by inviting people to go down to the ocean to immerse themselves back in their mother, and to remember that you are the ocean, and the ocean is you.
Yes.
And there is no separation.
Absolutely.
And life is animated water.
And, yes.
Funnily enough, that's at the end of the summit. That's one of the three main takeaways from this whole summit, which has included panelists from all sectors of interest. And that's one of the main takeaways. You know, this is what we need to remember. We are animated water, and we are the ocean. The ocean is us.
Absolutely. When is the last time you swam in the ocean?
About 2 weeks ago, we were doing one of our Hoora Moana coastal surveys.
Okay.
With our volunteer team.
Yes.
It was glorious.
Yes, I've been able to go at least once a week, and it's just so. I mean, I could almost live in the ocean or live on the beach. But look, let me ask you this: why do electronics and seawater not get along? And look at how much electronics is in our life. This has a lot to do with our disconnect from water, and is the electronic nature of our environment. In fact, that we're using electronic technology right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, it sure as heck doesn't like being anywhere close to salty water. That's for sure. I can attest to that, having gone through so much
cameras,
electronic gear, and cameras.
Absolutely.
With underwater photography.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm going to have to pass on that one, mate, because it's just, I'm a user of electronic technology, but
me too.
I'm an understander of it.
Well, it's kind of a love-hate thing.
Mostly, I just call it electricery.
That's a good one.
It's beyond me. You know, I have a love-hate relationship, I think, like a lot of people.
Yes.
Our modern communication technology, it facilitates a global village in terms of sharing experience, and it's got its real positives and it's got its real negatives. And I like to fantasize of a time when none of it exists.
Well, I was just going to say, what if
I can't imagine it now, because it's so much a part of an awful lot of what I do. I'm a communicator and a storyteller.
Exactly. But look, this is the paradox. This is the paradox that we're at, because you go like, well, look, I go like, well, I'm very thankful to digital photography, because if I had to make films using 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter, you got to be a millionaire to do that. And like, you know, recording and communicating like we're doing now, and telephones and all this different kind of stuff. But I go like, during the I've gone for over 4 months when we lived on Flinders Island, my partner and I, in 2011, not only off the grid, but with no electricity at all, nothing. Only we had camera batteries and batteries in our head torch and a landline. We had to drive 60 kilometers to go to the shop and go online and stuff. And so it's like, living away from those electrical fields, let your whole system recalibrates at a much higher level of sensitivity, and you feel like you're becoming a real person for what it really means. And so what I'm saying is, this ties in with our telepathic abilities and all kinds of ultra fine sensation and perception that I think is our true birthright as living beings. This electronic stuff might be the chronic nature that we're almost mutating to become it. We're, you know, the whole sort of that, the transhuman thing and stuff like that. But if it's blocking part of our abilities, and so if we shut it off, we might then really know, we might have the ability to have levels of information transfer of the complexity and order of magnitude of that we're able to do like we're doing right now. If it's stuff we needed to do, we might be able to do it, possibly even in ways we don't even understand, but the electronic stuff could be blocking it out, because it's like it's a different way of doing it, but it's dependent on an external technology.
You could be absolutely right. And you know, where we live, you know, we don't have any Wi-Fi networks around us unless we turn on our router.
Yep.
And we only turn it on when we need to use it.
Yes.
So we don't want to have any of this stuff just flying around us unless we're actually using it.
Yes.
And we choose to live in a place where there isn't the neighbor's Wi-Fi, isn't bombarding us. We just don't have that, and that's intentional. And the last sort of 6 to 8 weeks where we've just been sitting up here on the hill and just enjoying everything else getting quiet is, really has just been amazing. And I think that I've certainly experienced a deepening sense of connection, and felt much more in tune with this place through not having any of that stuff. And then, of course, I come in and I've got a Zoom meeting here, or
yes.
I need to work on a writing project or whatever in front of my computer. So yes. That stuff is still happening as well.
Absolutely. Well, but, you'll have to
turn it off.
You'll have to get your notepad.
Incredibly important.
Get a notepad and write a book using a notepad, just like in the old days, just to keep the. Because
if you looked at my desk, right now it's covered in notepads.
Keep the tradition alive.
What? So, yeah, and I've got a favorite pen that I use for making my notes.
Absolutely. I still write postcards a lot and stuff. I'm catching up on that. Look, let me throw this out. On my friends on Great Barrier Island, where, I spend probably more time than anywhere else in the past 20 years, one of the issues I've had there is a bioacoustic issue, because I'm always outside painting, and even in the night and even in the winter, I've got the doors and windows open, and I hear every plane flight that they had from the two little airlines going back and forth from Auckland. And there was times when I logged over 50 flights in between noon and 5 p.m. one day. This was a holiday, but it was almost like this really loud planes in the sky constantly, and I was monitoring this and always sort of trying to raise it as a bioacoustic issue for how many of these flights are actually necessary. And then I learned that they would have a flight from Auckland to Great Barrier with only one passenger, just because it was a scheduled flight, like a city bus or something. I go, but look, most people don't notice because they're in their house all the time with the stereo and the TV and blah, 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 or they're deaf. But I constantly monitored this bioacoustic thing, and I went like, well, my friends told me that during the past few weeks, they've come back in the past couple of weeks, but for a while, all these flights were grounded. And my friends are going like, oh, my God, it's the quietest it's been in 20 years. And I go, like, oh, my God, how ironic that I'm not there to experience this, because all you could hear would be the ocean and the birds. And I go, like, I asked my friend if he could record some of the silence for me. But, I'm actually getting ready to write a major letter to the council of the island and Auckland and the airlines and just ask them. I go, like, but look, is this not a great moment of renavigating and not necessarily returning to the level of exactly how business as usual was before? Surely we need, tourism is a good thing, flights are a good thing, it's a privilege, not something to be taken advantage of. It's a privilege and honor to be able to go to places like New Zealand and Great Barrier Island, but you don't have, like with everything, it's not the thing that we've done, it's the level that we've taken it to. We have to do more and more and more. We could do stuff that was actually be beneficial and intelligent without just going off the deep end. And so I'm asking them to consider not reinstating so many flights. But doesn't that make sense?
Jeff, you're talking absolute sense, and I just agree with you 150%. And, I still pay the rent by skippering dive boats, and I'm just kind of stepping away from that stuff as much as I possibly can. And part of the reason is because all those boats are powered by big diesel engines, and the noise pollution that's in the ocean,
the
1950s, the background noise pollution in the ocean on average is 8 times more.
Yes.
Than it was.
Well, see, but look.
That's like living with continuous heavy metal music.
Exactly. Well, look, let me throw this out. There's another thing that
I just can't get away from it. And, I'm totally with you. We have this opportunity. My sense is that it's going to need more than this one episode for people to come back to their senses and be able to listen to the world.
Yes.
But I'm hopeful and certainly doing everything I can to encourage my fellow humans that I come in contact with to at least consider what they were experiencing during the rahui and how much they enjoyed it and how they were affected by it, and not to forget that and to really make changes in their own personal lives and exactly what you were talking about, encourage the infrastructure of modern life to take a step back. We had an enforced step back and most people who were not concerned for their very life, most people are reporting that they had profound changes, and you know, to lose all of that and just to go, hey man, let's get back to business as usual as quickly as possible, which is what lots of people are talking about, you know, that would be a terrible missed opportunity.
Yes, well, let me ask you this. We should do, when you have the time, we should do a follow-up to this interview and continue with talking about what the real threats are to the ocean, and also how I haven't heard of any, almost no whale and dolphin strandings anywhere for the past couple of months. And I go, but that can't possibly, I mean, hopefully that's the reality, but it may be because they haven't been reported because people haven't been out and about to see it. And then also there's the issue of shrouds, protective covers on propellers, and all these sort of pragmatic things, reducing the plane flights and everything. We're up to the end of the hour, and let's stop for now, but let's do a part two soon.
Yeah, it's an area we were doing quite a bit of work, trying to work with local Māori who are very concerned about the health of the awa, the river.
Yes.
So we're hoping to do some work around, first of all, the relationship with this beautiful estuary there, and remembering that we're part of that estuary, and then seeing if we can actually improve our behavior so that estuary has a chance to return its Māori, its life force.
Yes, that is so beautiful. This is Jeff Phillips Wieferson talking with Glenn Adney over in New Zealand. And Glenn, it's been so fantastic talking with you. Let's do a part two soon. And so let me just ask you, what was the actual name of that summit, in case people might want to try to access information on that, or maybe you can tell me later. And also, what is your website?
Yeah, so the Ocean Summit, so this is part of the Ocean Race, which used to be the Volga Ocean Race, and they've got a very, very important new kaupapa, new purpose, which is to work towards healthy oceans. And so the Ocean Summit is part of that process. So if you just go to the oceanrace.com, and you'll be able to find the Ocean Summit, and it's been recorded. You can actually view the whole thing, which is actually 4 hours long.
Okay.
Our website is oceanspirit.org, oceanspirit.org, and we've been taking the opportunity to actually do some work on the website and make it a little more user friendly. So, yeah.
And one last question before I let you go. What about the America's Cup? When is that going to be?
I have no idea. I'm so disinterested in the America's Cup.
It's a rich man's thing, isn't it?
A bunch of rich boys playing with their toys without any great purpose. I have admiration for what the Ocean Race is trying to do, and bringing ocean lovers together all around the world. But for the America's Cup, it just seems to me to be rich boys playing with their toys.
Well, I wish Sir Peter Blake was still with us, because he was one of the coolest Kiwis that I know about.
Yeah, and he started his sailing career was the Ocean Race, which was back then called the Whitbread Round the World Race. And he was the first person to win all of the legs of the race, in one go.
Yes.
He was a great explorer, a great sailor, a great ocean advocate.
And he
and just like our dear friend Wade. So I'll just finish on passing on my love to Wade and to his beautiful wife Jan, partner of life Jan, and his their body of work is still such an inspiration to so many people.
Absolutely. I was so cool, so honored to be able to meet Jan and Wade and stay with them that time. And I'd like to learn more about Roger Grace. And also, Sir Peter Blake actually died in the line of duty.